Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Welcome to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this week, Benazir Bhutto.
Pakistan's former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto has returned home after 8 years in exile, promising to restore democracy to her country.
There was one blast we saw.
First, though, to Pakistan, where former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto has escaped an assassination attempt at her homecoming parade.
Pakistan's opposition leader Benazir Bhutto has called on military dictator General Pervez Musharraf to quit as president to avoid further violence in the country.
This is the first time Benazir Bhutto has called on General Musharraf to completely give up power.
Well, I think it's time for General Musharraf to leave.
Never before has General Musharraf been under such pressure from a rival with tacit support from the United States.
Benazir Bhutto has been a major figure in Pakistani politics since the late 1970s, and she is clearly a key player in the current political turmoil that is engulfing the nation. Elected Prime Minister twice and twice dismissed under a cloud of corruption, she remains a controversial figure in Pakistan. Despite this controversy, Benazir has been feted by the West, which sees her as a defender of democracy. So who is Benazir Bhutto, and why does she remain such a significant figure in Pakistan? The story of Benazir really begins with her father, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto. Akbar Ahmed is the chair of Islamic studies at the American University and was a former Pakistani ambassador.
Zulfikar Ali Bhutto was a fascinating character both in Pakistan and on the international stage. Because of him, his daughter Benazir Bhutto has an incredible platform. Now, Bhutto, of course, was a very effective foreign minister in the 1960s for President Ayub Khan, who was a military dictator. And Bhutto, I was a young man then in college, and I remember Bhutto first appearing on the scene, and he excited all of us in that generation. Here was a young foreign minister with dash and daring and with this bristling sense of nationalism. And it created a sense of pride in us in the young generation. So then when he led a movement against Ayub Khan, a movement for a very interesting kind of Pakistan, it escalated him from this somewhat glamorous, even a playboy kind of foreign minister image, to that of a serious politician in the South Asian context. For the first time in history, in modern politics in Pakistan, someone, and that is Bhutto, was talking about poverty, about a roof over the head for ordinary Pakistanis, for the peasants, for the villagers, for the tribal people. And they responded in their thousands. And overnight, Bhutto had created a constituency in a neglected part of Pakistan's society, which is the less privileged, the deprived. And that rapport, that charisma, is something that Benazir Bhutto can always count on. It's like a vote bank. It's there for her. They will not leave her because of the name Bhutto.
Zulfikar Ali Bhutto married the daughter of a wealthy Iranian businessman in 1951 and had four children. Libby Hughes is a writer and the author of Benazir Bhutto, From Prison to Prime Minister.
They had four children. Benazir was the first, and then Mir and Shah, two boys, and Sanam, the youngest girl. And Benazir, her father called her Pinky because her skin was so light, and she was the apple of his eye. And wherever he was in the world, he would always call her and ask how she was doing in school, what her reports were like, and he always encouraged her.
Benazir was educated at the Jesus and Mary Convent in Murray. The relationship with me starts then because my sisters were there, her contemporaries and friends, and they would tell me stories about Benazir, a very charismatic, even rebellious young girl and destined for something big.
And their father was away because he was at the UN, and he took Benazir because she was the oldest, very often with him to the UN. and also to the White House. And she sat, as a teenager, she sat next to Henry Kissinger. After the dinner, Henry Kissinger came up to her father and said, "Your daughter is almost as intimidating as you are."
And it was interesting that her role model was Fatima, Hazrat Fatima, the daughter of the Prophet of Islam. And she is the favored, beloved daughter of her father, a very special and extraordinary figure in Muslim culture. And every Muslim girl has a kind of fascination and attraction and adoration of Fatima. So Benazir identified herself with Fatima.
When she was 12, although her mother was liberated, her mother thought that perhaps she ought to wear the burqa that would cover her completely. And they were traveling on a train, and she said, "I think you should wear this." But when she put it on, everything she saw was sort of gray looking through this burqa. And she said, "I don't want to wear it." Her father said, "There's no need for her to wear that. She doesn't need to wear that." And she graduated from high school probably just before she was 16. And then her father said, "I want you to go to Radcliffe, part of Harvard University." So she came to the States, and John Kenneth Galbraith, who had been ambassador to India, was a friend of Ali Bhutto's, Benazir's father, and he said that he would look after her. I mean, when she went there, she didn't know how to do anything because she came from a privileged family. She didn't know how to do laundry. She didn't know how to answer a telephone. She was completely spoiled.
In 1973, Benazir's father, Ali Bhutto, became Pakistan's first elected prime minister.
She finished Oxford in 3 years, and she wanted to come home and help her father. And he said, "Look, I want you to go back for one more year at Oxford and take international law." And at the end of that time, she came back, and she worked in his office and started sorting out his files. And one of his top aides was General Zia al-Haq. And Benazir had a very uneasy feeling about him. Well, it wasn't long before a coup took place, and General Zia took over the power of the Pakistani government.
In Pakistan, on the 4th of April 1979, a brief news announcement on the radio ended months of uncertainty about the fate of the former Prime Minister, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto.
A press note issued by the Ministry of Interior in Islamabad today says, following conviction by the Lahore High Court, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto was hanged to death at 2 o'clock this morning in Rawalpindi District Jail.
Mr. Bhutto had been put on trial after allegations that he'd ordered the murder of a political opponent during the election of 1977. He was found guilty by the Pakistan Supreme Court, but not by an absolute majority. Four judges found him guilty, three innocent.
It was just devastating for both she and her mother. And what they did was they kept promoting democracy and working with the PPP, the Pakistan People's Party. And eventually she was put under house arrest. Then she was put in Sukkur Jail, which is part of that desolate desert. And it was just one huge building, concrete building, with only four barred windows in it. She had to endure 120 degrees of heat in the daytime, and at night the cold winds would sweep off the mountains and come through those barred windows, and it would be 40 degrees, and she had no blankets. Her hair began to fall out in clumps, and she decided that she had to do something to keep her mind occupied. And so one of the jailers gave her a notebook, and she began recording everything that happened to her. And eventually that became her book, Benazir Bhutto, Daughter of Destiny.
You're listening to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and the web with me, Annabelle Quince. In today's program, we're taking a look at the story of Benazir Bhutto. In 1984, the Pakistani military allowed Benazir to return to the UK, where she became the leader in exile of the Pakistan People's Party. Then, in 1988, a mysterious plane crash killed the then president of Pakistan, General Zia.
Sabotage is the most likely cause of the aircraft explosion which claimed the life of President Zia and 31 other people, including the chairman of Pakistan's Joint Chiefs of Staff and the American ambassador.
Now Zia's death has broken the armed forces' hold on power. With the generals out of politics, democracy has a chance.
Fatima Bhutto is a writer and poet, the niece of Benazir Bhutto and the granddaughter of Ali Bhutto.
So it was a time in Pakistan's history where you had all segments almost of society that came out to resist martial law. And it's the one time it happened and it's never happened since. You had doctors, you had movements by playwrights and writers, artists, women's groups, students. So it was a time when the Pakistani populace was really engaged in resistance. In terms of succeeding my grandfather, that's never what he intended. Zulfikar Ali Bhutto was a progressive man, and he never intended to found a party or to lead a political movement that would be passed down like a family business.
In the 1988 general election, Benazir led the Pakistan People's Party and was elected Prime Minister of Pakistan.
As Benazir took her place in the National Assembly for the first time, the House broke into spontaneous applause, most already accepting her leadership. Though grudging opponents chose to wait silently for the official announcement.
And she began to betray, really, and reverse the original manifesto of the party. She began to work against the legacy of her father. Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, for example, took Pakistan out of the Commonwealth. He took us out because he believed it was a neo-colonial way of Britain managing its former colonies, and we were a sovereign country. So Zulfikar Ali Bhutto took us out of the Commonwealth. One of the first things Benazir Bhutto did was beg to be let back in under her first government. Zulfikar Ali Bhutto was a socialist. He was interested in endogenous economic development and economic dignity, and he nationalized some key industries. Now, Benazir reversed that. She privatized, and she privatized badly, really, putting her husband in charge. Her husband, during her first term, was a minister of privatization and of foreign investment, and what they created was an oligarchy.
Now, this is how I see it. Just the fact that a female prime minister had become a prime minister was sufficient. Just the fact that, for the first time in history, you had a female prime minister of a Muslim land elected into office was more than enough in terms of symbolism, in terms of substance. Now, the reality of the situation in Pakistan is this. It is a male-dominated society. It is a patriarchal society. It is a society dominated by tribal chiefs, by large landlords, but also the army, once again, a male preserve. Now, in that environment, for a frail girl to arrive fresh from Oxford and the West and so on, speaking Urdu but not entirely Urdu in the way it's understood in Pakistan, and then trying to impose some ideas of progress and democracy and women's rights and a new, fresh way of thinking, was almost doomed to failure. So that very quickly she ran up against the establishment. Very quickly, she ran up against her own limitations, and very quickly, she was out of office with all kinds of charges where she was most vulnerable. Herself and her husband, Asif Zardari, they became the target of gossip and slander and all kinds of accusations. Her husband was widely reputed to take money, certain percentage of every deal that was conducted by government and so on. This was the rumor mill of Pakistan. And then once she came back the second time, it was more or less a repeat performance.
Benazir had become Prime Minister in 1988 and was dismissed 2 years later amidst allegations of corruption. She was re-elected in 1993 and dismissed once again in 1996, also for corruption. Charges that have dogged both her and her husband ever since.
But there's also no doubt that a magistrate in Switzerland found her guilty of money laundering.
Benazir Bhutto knew she was acting in a criminally reprehensible manner by abusing her role in order to obtain for herself or her husband considerable sums in the sole private interest of her family at the cost of the Islamic Republic of Pakistan.
Daniel DeVoe sentenced her and her husband to 180 days in prison in absentia and ordered them to pay $11.9 million back to Pakistan.
Benazir and her husband were convicted by the Swiss courts in the Katekna corruption case, and for receiving approximately $11 million worth in kickbacks. Benazir is currently appealing that decision, but until the conviction is reversed, it stands. She's also being tried in Spain on a money laundering charge in Valencia. She's got a property commissions case against her in England, and she's involved in the oil for food scandal. And the oil for food scandal involves Benazir alone, not her husband.
I would say, knowing the nature of government, that there are grey areas. There's no doubt about it. When you're in power, there's so many things that become grey. You're using or misusing the car, the transport, the telephones, the air flights. All this becomes subject to scrutiny, debate, controversy. Having said that, again, put this in context. She is in opposition. She is in exile. There's a military government. The military government targets her. She becomes the main target, along with Nawaz Sharif, the other former prime minister. And the military government now uses its machinery to do two things: to tarnish the image of both of them, both the prime ministers who are abroad, and secondly, to put so much pressure on the leader of the political party that ordinary members of that party would then fall away and join the government, the new government. And that's what happened. To her credit, I know there are cases in the UK and Switzerland and so on, she stood and fought and has constantly denied the existence of these cases.
During her second term in office, Benazir's younger brother, Murtaza Bhutto, was a constant critic of her policies and her leadership. In 1996, he was killed in a police ambush.
In Pakistan, two inquiries are underway to establish the circumstances in which a police shootout killed Murtaza Bhutto, the brother of Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto.
But opposition parties have dismissed both inquiries as a cover-up operation. They say the government should take responsibility for what they describe as state-sponsored terrorism.
My father was killed on the 20th of September 1996. He entered the street where our house is located, and the roads had been cordoned off. The street lights had been shut. There were 70 to 100 policemen at the scene of the crime, including several in trees in sniper positions. And my father was shot several times, but the shot that killed him was one fired execution style into his neck at point blank range. Now, Benazir's government was instrumental in the cover-up in several ways. First, they denied my family the right to file a police report. That is an inalienable right granted to every Pakistani citizen. Secondly, Benazir's government did not arrest any of the police involved. They were internally cleared and honorably reinstated to their positions. And the third thing she did was that she didn't allow our family to pursue a criminal case. What she did was she convened a tribunal that had no legal authority to pass sentence. It had no legal authority to convict anybody. And the terms of reference that were set forbade the prosecution, which was us, to use anything decided on in the tribunal in a court of law. But the tribunal was very important in three ways. They ruled, first of all, that it was an assassination. It was a premeditated assassination. Secondly, they ruled that the police used an excess amount of force, in that the six men who were killed with my father, including my father, were left to bleed for about 45 minutes. They were not taken to medical facilities. And the third thing that they ruled, which is tremendously important, is that the operation itself could not have happened without approval from the highest level of government. Now, at the time, there is nothing higher than the Prime Minister's office.
Here's a Prime Minister, her own brother shot in Karachi in cold blood. It was a terrible murder. And that has left a stain on her reputation, and I believe it would have scarred her. But again, put it in context. This is on one level political. On another level, there's a psychological drama taking place. It's a patriarchal society. I'm sure her brother would believe that he, not Benazir, not his sister, was the genuine inheritor of the mantle of their father. And that somehow Benazir had got this privilege and had used this privilege, or rather misused it. And it was time that he came back to Pakistan. He'd been in exile and assumed the mantle. So there was an inherent structural rivalry of brother and sister, political rivals, psychological rivals, very classic Shakespearean, one family, two major political figures clashing. Then there was the husband. There was tension between Benazir's husband Zardari and his brother-in-law, Benazir's brother. How do you resolve that? Who is the number one? Who is speaking? Who's, as it were, wearing the pants in the family?
In 1999, democracy was suspended in Pakistan in a military coup, and Benazir once again went into self-imposed exile. She only returned last month after negotiating a deal with General Pervez Musharraf. But many questions remain about just how much support she retains in Pakistan.
If you look on the streets now, I mean, Benazir has lost a tremendous amount of credibility by negotiating and continuing to negotiate with the military government of General Pervez Musharraf, and by proving herself only too enthusiastic to work with the Bush White House. You know, what she did for her return was ultimately, it was theater, it was a media event. Now, when Benazir first returned to Pakistan after exile in 1988, she boarded a plane, she landed in Lahore, and a million people came out to receive her in solidarity and support because of her father, because of what she represented at that time. But if you look at 2007, two things happened. Her party embarked on a tremendous campaign that had two parts. The first was a media blitz, and they were estimated to have spent a minimum of 100 million rupees. And the second thing they did is that every party officer, every party bearer, every representative at the provincial or national level was told to fill rickshaws, buses, trucks, taxis, and bring people from their districts to Karachi to create a welcome wagon for Benazir. And even at that, they managed to bring about 200,000 people, which is quite a step down from a million in 88. And what happened is that there was a double suicide blast that night, and Benazir came out the next day and she held a press conference. And she said in that press conference that she had been warned three times that there would be an attack. And the question on the streets of Pakistan were, well, if she was warned, and if she took the precautions to get herself a bulletproof car and to surround herself with armed guards, why did she not protect these people? Why did she bring them and ultimately leave them vulnerable?
I think the phantom of her father is ever present, and everything that he told her and his sense of morality and principles have had such an impact, such an inspiration to her, that she will never give up. To be the savior of Pakistan is more important to her than anything else in life.
But ultimately, as I said to you earlier, she is a feudal. She believes that power is owed to her, and she believes it's a birthright. For her, the name Bhutto is property. It's property that only she can own. And that's symptomatic, really, of what's wrong with this country. We have a nation of 165 million people that are being held hostage. They're being held hostage to a power play, to a battle of personal ambition. For all fairness, Benazir has had her chances. She has been elected twice, and she has failed twice. And bringing her back into power only damages the cause of democracy in this country. It only goes against the people of Pakistan. And I think she's had her chances. It's time for her to step aside.
Fatima Bhutto ending today's program. Thanks to sound engineer Timothy Nicastri and to ABC Archives. You've been listening to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National with me, Annabel Quince. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.